last of the chapters we'll be covering, so chapter 10. So, again, just to remind people, we will not be covering chapter 11, even though it was listed on the syllabus. I was overly ambitious having set up that syllabus without actually having had a chance to yet read the textbook. So, we will not be doing that. So, the final exam will cover stuff up to the end of today's lecture. All right, so the last chapter looks at issues of aversive control, specifically avoidance and punishment. Now, we talk about escape and avoidance procedures, and they're related, but subtly different. In the case of escape, what is happening is you are getting away from an aversive stimulus that is in progress. If you all got up and left the room right now, that would be escape. Well, hopefully it's not that aversive. Avoidance is doing something that actually prevents the delivery of an aversive stimulus. If you didn't come at all today, if you stayed at home, that would be avoidance. Okay, so avoidance, make a response, and the aversive is never delivered. Escape, the aversive is delivered, you make a response which stops it, terminates the aversive stimulus. So we've got a negative contingency here going on between a response and the aversive stimulus. So the more you make the response, the less you're going to get the aversive stimulus experienced. So what we see then with these kinds of protocols is an increase in operant responding. Operant responses will increase. The probably the earliest study that specifically looked at this was by Brogdon and colleagues in 1938. Worked with guinea pigs. We don't see a lot being done with guinea pigs anymore, which is kind of a shame. They're very nice laboratory animals to work with. I've never been bitten by a guinea pig. They're diurnal, which means they're awake the same time people are, as opposed to rats and mice, which are nocturnal. Quite easy to house, easy to feed. So, anyways, at some point we just stopped using them. You see very few studies with guinea pigs anymore. Anyways, here's what they did. They had a tone, and they said that's your CS, and they had a shock, and that's your US. Therefore, the pain caused by the shock would be your UR. And they had a little running wheel. Now, they said the CR is going to be running. Now, here's the thing. They contextualized this within a classical conditioning framework. And what's kind of interesting about this study is that it took a little while before anyone sort of stopped and went, wait a minute, we've got an operant contingency in place here. The vast majority of the work that was being done in the 20s and 30s in terms of operant or instrumental conditioning or learning was involving getting appetitive outcomes, so increasing behaviors through appetitive outcomes. And so when they set it up this way, in some respects it seemed very much just like they contextualized it classically, and people didn't really question this for a little while. Anyway, I mean, they even called their groups the classical group and the avoidance group. So here's what happened. In their classical conditioning group, and this is quite correct, they are basically just doing a classical conditioning paradigm in this group. So in this case here, the CS is presented, the tone is presented, and regardless of whatever the guinea pigs do, they are always going to get the US delivered. So perfect contingency here, classical conditioning contingency, CS, US. Now, in this case, they're not actually going to get a CR of running, right? Because why would the guinea pigs really be well, the guinea pigs may be running. They may be like trying to flee in the wheel, but it's not really a conditional response, as it turns out. So they've got a little wheel they can run in. If they're getting shocked, they can hop on the wheel and run, but it's not going to terminate the shock there. Their avoidance group, in this case here, if the CS is followed by the is followed by the CR, so if in the presence of the CS the guinea pigs start running, this prevents the delivery of the US. If in the presence of the CS the guinea pigs do not start running on the wheel, they get shocked. So this is their avoidance group. And if we look at the data here, we find that very, very quickly our avoidance group, the ones that are basically doing an operant schedule here, we get up to within like, 6-7 days of training, basically 100%. They just stop there. It's like, well, they can't get any better. Time to stop training the avoidance group. Our classical group here, I mean, you know, peaks at 50% condition responding on this day here, day whatever that is, 13. But, I mean, most of the time, you know, we're getting operant responses somewhere, you know, averaging probably around 20-odd percent of the time. Because, you know, running doesn't do anything for these guinea pigs. Probably doesn't even make the pain from the shock less intense, less aversive. So we get this. And as I said, it took a number of years before anyone sort of said, wait a second, we don't think you're actually really doing a... It's like, yeah, your classical group is classical conditioning, sure, but your avoidance group, that's not actually classical conditioning. You've got a wacky, wonky little operant situation here. And so this got people talking about discriminative avoidance. And this then led specifically to the development of studies designed to test this on purpose. So basically here, in a discriminative avoidance learning task, we've got the following. We'll even call it, to use the same terminology of Brogdon here, if in the presence of a CS, your response is made, I'm not going to call it a CR, I'm just going to call it a response. Okay, if a response is made, then no US is delivered. On an escape trial, if the CS is on, but the response isn't made early on here, eventually the US will be delivered, but I've tried to line these up here. Once the response gets made, this terminates the US. Okay, so that would be your escape. The response actually shuts off the aversive unconditional stimulus. So that's what we'd see here, the difference. And typically what happens is in any of these studies, subjects will start with escape behavior and then hopefully progress on to learning to avoid if there's the potential for actually doing avoidance responding. They'll usually start with escape, and then after getting a number of these stimulus shock or stimulus aversive outcomes, they'll eventually get to the point where they start doing the make the response to terminate the aversive, and then at some point they'll make a response before the aversive is delivered and realize, hey, the aversive didn't get delivered at all, and then they'll shift on to avoidance behavior there. The standard way that by the 1950s, very early 1950s, that was being utilized to test this were called shuttle box studies. This became the standard, the sort of industry standard, if you will, and still the standard today. You go online and do a search for shuttle boxes, you'll find very few of them that are designed for dogs like this, although I guess you can buy those. Most of them are designed for mice or rats, pigeons, things like that, smaller laboratory studies. We also don't do very much research with dogs anymore either. But your standard sort of shuttle box would, this would be the basic principle. So there's going to be a floor that can deliver a shock. There'll be, well, these are speakers, so perhaps a speaker on each side here that can produce a tone, or it could be a light or whatever. But there's going to be a stimulus delivery system on each side. There's either a hurdle or a little barrier, or in some cases it's even just a line painted down, painted on the floor. In the case of the dogs, dogs are quite readily able to hop over little hurdles like this. But it could even just be a line. All it's really there for, it's not there to try to make it difficult for them to do, to get from one side to the other, to shuttle, hence that's why it's called a shuttle box, to shuttle from one side to the other. It's really just there to demarcate side one from side two. So if the stimulus comes on and a shock is being delivered, if they hop to the other side, that's the response. The shock then is not being delivered on the other side, so their behavioral response terminates the shock. With exposure to this, with training, when the speaker turns on, when they hear the tone, they make their shuttle response, and they never get the shock. So, as I said here, in the case of escape in the shuttle box, in the presence of the aversive stimulus, you make your response. The aversive is terminated. Now, this is actually really easy to explain in terms of operant contingencies. This is a straightforward negative reinforcement. You've got some pain, you're experiencing pain, you make a response, the response does something that takes the pain away. In future, you are more likely to make that response. So, pain removed, behavior increases. Negative, removed, reinforcement, an increase in the behavior. Escape behavior is really, really easy in this sense to understand. And it was pretty much as soon as people realized that Brodgen's and colleagues' study wasn't really, you know, their avoidance group wasn't really an odd classical conditioning system per se, as soon as this got contextualized in operant terms, it's like, yeah, escape, that's straightforward. We got that. That's negative reinforcement. Avoidance is a little bit trickier to conceptualize. And by the early 40s, people were starting to call this an avoidance paradox. It has nothing to do with doing training with two or more oxen. Okay. No humor with that? Okay. Well, that joke will be taken out of usage. That's called punishment. All right. So, in the case of avoidance, you make a response before the aversive is delivered. The behavior increases. You are more likely, in future, to make that behavior a response. You'll make it faster as soon as the stimulus is presented. You're more likely to do that shuttle. You'll make it more frequently. You're just less likely to get the shock. So you make the avoidance behavior more. So we've got reinforcement. Nobody really argued about that. It's like, yeah, behavior increases. Good, reinforcement. The problem was it a negative or a positive? I mean, in escape, we saw you take the shock away, your behavior increases, negative reinforcement. But nothing's really taken away here. You don't get the shock, right? That's the whole point. You do the behavior before the shock's delivered, so it's not like you're taking the pain from the shock away. And it's not exactly clear that anything's being delivered. It's not like, you know, it's not like most of the way that the operant studies are being done at the time, where if you were to shuttle to the other side, you'd get an appetitive, you'd get like some food. It's like, yeah, make that shuttle response, get some food. Well, you won't get shocked, but if you come on over here, we'll give you a treat. That wasn't happening. So Maurer and Lamro in 42 said, you know, quote, not getting something can hardly in and of itself qualify as rewarding. So this is what they meant by the avoidance paradox. It seemed very difficult to try to conceptualize what was either being removed or delivered. So what was motivating making the avoidance response? Clearly it was happening. Nobody questioned that. Nobody questioned that it was avoidance. Nobody questioned it was reinforcing. But this was a problem, or at least it was perceived to be a problem. The first solution to this that was proposed in the 40s was by a guy called Miller, not that you really need to know that, was the two-process theory of avoidance learning. Two-process theory, and it's a little bit unfortunate because we've also got the two-process theory of learning in general, which says classical and operant conditioning are two separate learning processes. So, you know, psychologists don't come up with original terms for things. They just seem to keep recycling the same ideas and words over and over and over again. You'd think there'd be a lot of terms we could use, but no. We could have called this the Kablawi theory of avoidance, just something that would, but no, we don't. We're psychologists. You think we'd be better at coming up with things that we could distinguish and, you know, categorize, but we suck at this. Anyways, so two-process theory of avoidance. It says there's two mechanisms. Sorry, there'd be four mechanisms. I held my fingers. There's two mechanisms. There's a classical and an instrumental process. Hence, two. The classical has to happen first. So it says during the initial training, during the escape period, stimulus indicates So in the presence of a stimulus, you get shocked, you make a response that terminates the shock. It says, during this period, once the subject starts making escape responses, and remember, the initial escape response is going to be very Thorndikean. It's going to be very trial and error, right? So our dog, our hypothetical dog there in the shuttle box gets shocked, goes, yip, and it sort of jumps around a bit, and eventually it leaps over the little barrier there. It goes, oh, hey, no shock over here. Okay, so in this sense, it's very much like Thorndike's cats in the puzzle box. Just try different things, and eventually they do something that terminates the aversive, and that gets stamped in. Okay, so during that, during our escape sort of learning period here, the two-process theory says we've got classical conditioning going on. Straight up, straightforward, traditional Pavlovian learning here. So when the stimulus is presented, so bzz, tone comes on, and then zappo, shock is delivered. The tone serves as a CS. The shock serves as a US. The shock produces a UR of pain, and a CR of fear, let's call it fear, is produced. So the stimulus, the tone comes on. Hypothetical, we're just using tones. You could use a light, you could use whatever. But let's say it's a tone. So the tone is presented, the CS is presented, it's paired with the US. CR of fear is the outcome for this. So this is just our standard classical conditioning. Nothing tricky here. It says, then, at some point, we get into a negative reinforcement operant contingency. So, at some point, what happens here is by making a response early, so the conditional stimulus is presented. A little bit later, the shock's going to be delivered. So let's say the CS is turned on 8 seconds before the delivery of shock. If a response is made, if the dog shuttles to the other side, no shock is delivered, right? Okay, so that's our basic there. Now, negative reinforcement. By this time, through all this escape training, we've got a CS that generates fear. So tone is turned on. The dog becomes afraid. If it goes to the other side of the box, it removes itself from the presence of the CS, right? The tone is on one side, the dog's on the other, so it's removed itself from the fear-eliciting stimulus. It's stopped the CR, in essence. By getting away from the CS, it's eliminated the fear, which is caused by that CS. So, this is the way the two-process theory operates. Is you first got to go through a classical conditioning phase. Then, once you got that, the classical conditioning provides, if you will, the motivation to make the avoidance response. It says these are two separate processes. It says you got the classical component, the instrumental component. They're independent. Okay, it's not like some of our, our RGSG interpretation, where the classical conditioning is inherently worked into our instrumental learning process to provide motivation. This one, the two-process theory here is saying, no, you learn your classical conditioning, it's an independent process, and then we've got our, once that's been acquired sufficiently, then we get some operant conditioning as well, but they're two separate things. So, in essence, two-process theory says that avoidance is really just escape. So we understand escape. Escape is negative reinforcement. You take away the pain caused by the shock. Boom, there we go. It says, in this case, what we've been calling avoidance all this time is escape. It's not escape from the shock, because that hasn't been delivered yet. It's escape from the fear produced by the stimulus telling you the shock is coming. So essentially, you're escaping from the fear caused by the CS. So really, it's negative reinforcement again. So two processes, it's all about escape. You're just escaping from something else. Okay? Now, Damian seems to love the two-process theory. He really, really likes it. If you have read through the chapter, he'll talk about how it's the standard theory against all, which all others have to be measured, and all of this kind of stuff. Despite the fact that it's got some staggering problems, but anyways, we'll come to those. Anyhow, so acquired drive. So this then started to get studied a lot and evaluated in terms of, because the two process theory here gets you out of the avoidance paradox, right? There is something actually that's being taken away. It's not something dealing directly with the shock. It's the fear that's been classically conditioned through a CSUS associative phase. Okay, so acquired drive experiments then. Specifically, you set this up. Phase one, condition fear to a conditional stimulus through a classical conditioning protocol. You don't have to do this. There's a shuttle box, right? You just take your rat or your pigeon or your dog or your hippopotamus or whatever you want it is, you know, turn on a tone or a light, anything, give it a shock or some other sort of aversive. You got to be careful if you're working with hippos because they're big and, you know, more people are killed every year by hippopotamuses than by lions, all right? You do not want to piss off the hippo. Hippos go on rampages through villages and stomp on people. They're very, it's like more people are actually injured by elk every year than bears, and yet we're all worried about the bears in Jasper. It's like, no, dudes, you should totally worry about the elk. In the fall, the males are in rutting season. They're horny, and they're angry, and they're looking to bash somebody with their antlers, okay? In the spring, you've got mummy elk that have just had babies. They're really hyper-protective. They want to know where the babies are all the time, and they're just freaking ready to trample anything that gets close to their, you know, close to Bambi. Oh, yeah. The bears are just like, look, dude, I'm just looking for some berries or something, okay? I mean, she's like, you know, I'll take your cooler. You know, you left some food out. I'll just take that. But I really don't want to do anything with you. Okay. No, instead. Okay, anyways, my point is, whatever subject you're working with, okay, we give it an aversive standard, straight-up classical conditioning. That's it. Okay? Do it wherever you want, however you want. Set it up. We're just pairing a CS with an aversive US. Great. Phase two. Now we train a subject to make an operant response. Okay? So we've got some operant response going on here. So we just train that up. So just put it in an operant chamber. Blah, 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 press a lever to get some food. Okay? Then present the CS. See what happens. We could do things like, you know, so our condition suppression would say, you know, are you going to respond less when you are in the presence of our CS that produces fear? Or you can do it. You can do it other ways. You can even just set it up such that now what you can do is you can even set it. This is actually the way I wrote this initially here. You can even set it up so you put it into an operant situation. So our tone, our CS that has been paired with the US of fear is presented, and if you press the lever, you turn off the tone. But there's no shock actually delivered in our phase two. What you're actually doing is just turn off the tone. That's stunningly reinforcing for rats and pigeons and anything, dogs that have been trained in this. It's like in phase one, tone means shock. In phase two, they're not going to get shocked, but if you make your response, you can just stop that really scary tone. The thing that you don't like. It's like, got commercials on TV that you don't like? Press the mute, it goes away. Change the channel. Ooh, it's gone. Okay. Or you can do the variant on this, which is now more commonly used, which is the condition suppression process, where you've trained your subject up to make responses for food, then you present your conditional stimulus, and you see if the responding decreases during the presentation of that. In either case, these sorts of studies, these acquired drive experimental designs, the variants of them that there are, show that, yes, in fact, a conditional stimulus, a CS plus indicating an aversive US, can alter operant responding. That these can actually lead to an influence on the operant responding. They'll either operantly respond just to stop that aversive, what's become an aversive CS, or, in fact, the aversive CS can actually reduce operant responding, particularly in rats. Rats have this very nice fear response that if they're frightened by things, they very commonly freeze, and that just leads to the condition suppression. So here's one. Brown and Jacobs. They got rats in a shuttle box. They got experimental and control groups. Phase one, a light tone combination is paired up So light tone pairing is presented with a shock. So the light tone becomes the CS for shock. Phase two, present the CS. No shock is actually going to be delivered, but the rats don't know that. They can turn the CS off by crossing a barrier. So they hop over a little wall there onto the other side of the shuttle box. CS turned off. The light tone goes away. And all they did here, very simply, was measure the time it took for them to change sides. Went down. Okay, so with learning that they could shut off the CS by hopping over the barrier, this supports the two-process interpretation, two-process theory. It says, yeah, we've got a CS, an aversive, a CS plus indicating an aversive US, and the rats will respond to get rid of that. Seems to fit very nicely with two-process theory here. Roscorla and Lalordo did it in a slightly different way. Same concept, slightly different approach here. They've got dogs in a shuttle box. No signal is being presented at this point. Now, in this case, there's no obvious stimulus, CS or discriminant stimulus here. Periodically, they're just going to get a shock. So periodically, the dogs are going to get shocked. It's on a random schedule. If the dogs make a response, if they shuttle to the other side, this gives them some safe time. So every time you shuttle, you get 20 seconds, let's say, in which you will not be shocked. What happens is after a while, the dogs get kind of consistent at this. You know, they'll wait maybe 15, 16, 17 seconds, and then they'll go back to the other side of the shuttle box. So they hang around for, you know, it's kind of like a fixed interval thing here. Right. They don't want to wait too long because they're in shock, so they typically start making the response before the time is up. Okay, so they shuttle over, and in this way, the dogs get very good at not getting shocked. Once they had the dogs at that level, once the response was quite consistent, very stable, responding there, they take the dogs out of the shuttle box, and they just do straight-up classical conditioning. They pair a tone with a shock. Okay, so just straight classical conditioning here. They then put the dogs back into the shuttle box. Well, not all at the same time, obviously. One dog at a time into a shuttle box. And the dog goes back to doing its standard shuttling behavior. It goes right back to its sort of stable response rate there. They present the tone. So let's say the dog has just shuttled. It should have 20 seconds of safety. It should wait maybe 16, 17 seconds before making another response. They turn on the tone. The dog shuttles. The tone is a CS plus indicating the delivery of the US. The dogs have learned, in the presence of the tone, you're going to get a shock. What do you do? What do you do to avoid getting a shock? You shuttle. Wait a minute, I just shuttled. Yeah? But I'm hearing a stimulus, I'm hearing a tone that says, I'm going to get shocked real soon. What do? Shuttle again. Dude, you should have, like, you know, 20 seconds of safety. Yeah, I got a tone, it's a coming, I'm going to get shocked, time to go. So they do that. Now, another group, Briscola and Lalordo, set up a CS minus. Okay, so we've got a CS plus indicating shock delivery, but if there's a CS minus, so if tone indicates shock is coming. A light with the tone, light becomes a CS minus, says, oh no, if there's a light, it's okay, don't worry about it. You're not going to get shocked. In that case, so with that group of subjects, they put the dogs back in the shuttle box. They're going back to their standard response rate of shuttling back and forth every maybe 17 seconds. So in this case here, now, the dog shuttled. It's been waiting here for, you know, 15 seconds, 16 seconds. Just about to shuttle again, present the CS minus. Present the light. Dog goes, oh, okay, I'm not getting shocked. Sits back down. Right? The CS minus says, don't worry about it. No, shock's not coming on this trial. So they'll wait longer than the 20 seconds. Now, obviously, when they're testing this, right, these are probe trials, they're not actually going to shock the dogs, because if the CS minus says you're not going to get shocked, then you really do get a shock, you're going to extinguish your CS minus learning, right? Okay. So, but in this case here, dogs don't know that. From their point of view, here the CS minus, shock's not coming, they stay put. They hang out longer. So, again, this is evidence that seems to fit very nicely with the two-process theory. We've got some classical conditioning that can come in and modify operant behavior. Okay, that's essentially what the two-process theory is saying here. But there are some difficulties with this. First, for the two-process theory to work, fear is a necessary component. You must have a CR of fear. There has to be something that is motivating the response. There's something that you, there has to be something that you're escaping from. Now, one of the difficulties with this is that numerous studies have looked at this, and the better you get, the better your subject gets, even with humans, the better people get at making avoidance responses, the less afraid they seem to be. I don't care if you're using physiological measures, blood pressure, heart rate, respiration, digestion rate, galvanic skin response, whatever it is, most of the studies that look at this show that your physiological indicators of fear are decreasing. If you do this with people and you actually ask them, are you feeling, you know, rate your fear on a scale of 1 to 10. How much fear would you say you are experiencing? Once people get really good at avoiding, they don't really say that they're afraid. It's like, why to be afraid? I figured out how to avoid. I'm not going to get shocked, or, you know, I've gotten pretty good at faking being sick and, you know, calling in sick for work, you know. Aren't you worried that your boss is going to find out and fire? It's like, not really. You know, I stole my doctor's, you know, prescription pad. I just, you know, I scrawl something on there. Nobody can read doctor's any handwriting anyways. It's just like, hey, here's a note from my doctor. It's like, yeah, okay, sure, I guess so. What's it saying? Migraine. Oh, yeah, I see it now. Right, yeah. You're not afraid? Not so much. Okay. Now, some studies actually have demonstrated this very nicely, that the fear reduces. Kamen, Brimmer, and Black were some of the first to show this. Very, very nice study, very elegant. They had rats. They trained rats to lever press in an operant chamber to get food. Okay, so this is a conditioned, essentially it's a conditioned suppression study. Okay, and this is sort of what made conditioned suppression studies in rats so popular. Azrin and others were around the same time, bit before this, from the late 50s, were demonstrating some sort of species-specific defensive reactions. And in rats, you can get some very specific responses. I think it was the last class we talked about, like, the bar biting in rats. So if they're getting aversives, they'll, like, gnaw on things, bite things. In other cases, they'll freeze. If there's nothing to bite or nothing they can vent their frustration on, they'll just often freeze. So Azrin and others were showing that, and Kamen, Brimmer, and Black took advantage of this. So they trained their rats to lever press for food. So they're a little bit food deprived. Food's a good motivator. There they go. They get them up to a consistent level for responding. Then they shift them into a shuttle box. Okay, so we're out of the operant chamber. We're into the shuttle box. They've got an auditory CS, so tone, that will indicate shock. So tone goes on. Shortly after, shock is going to be delivered. They got four groups of rats. The first group of rats will keep doing shuttle box training until they have made one successful avoidance response. So again, they start out with escape. It's like, hey, there's a tone. I wonder what that... Yeah, I'm getting shocked. Ah. Shuttle to the other side. Boom, that's escape, right? First group of rats. They stay in the shuttle box. They keep doing training trials until they make one successful avoidance response. It's like, okay, you're done. Second group of rats. They keep going until they've made three successful responses in a row. Now, what that means is they're actually going to end up doing a lot more trials here than group one, right? You make one successful avoidance response, but then you goof and you're back to an escape because you haven't quite figured out that your response actually caused you not to get a shock, right? So, you know, then you do a few more escape trials. Then you actually shuttle before the shock is delivered. So there's one avoidance, but then you got to make two in a row, then three in a row. You know, they're going to end up doing more trials. Third group has to do 9 successful avoidance responses in a row. Again, it's going to be a bugger if you slip up on trial 7 and get shocked again. You got to start over at 1. So again, they're going to have a fourth group, 27 successful avoidance trials in a row. They're going to do hundreds and hundreds of learning trials. Basically, what we've got here is kind of an exponential training schedule. The group 27 rats should know a lot about avoidance. They should be really, really good at this. Now, according to the two-process theory then, the reason that group 27 rats are so good at avoiding is because they've had all these associations between the CS and the US. In other words, they've learned CS produces a fear response. CS means you're going to get shocked. You get a strong conditional response of fear. That's why they're so good at doing these avoidance responses, because there's no question about should I be scared right now or not. It's like, holy, you know, holy rat poop, Batman. No, it doesn't work. Holy rat poop, Skinner. There we go. Shocks are coming. What do? Shuttle. There you go. So, they've got that. They put the groups back into, they put the rats back into the operant chamber. Rats go pressing away quite happily on the bar. Get some food, okay? And then, periodically, they turn on the tone. Now, they're not going to give them a shock, okay? So they just turn on the tone, and they see what happens. Well, we get, you know, our standard thing's going to be suppression, right? It's this thingy with rats. If they're frightened, they often freeze up. If you're frozen, if you're not moving, right, except for breathing, you know, you're not going to be pressing the lever, so lever pressing is going to go down. They've got an odd sort of adjusted suppression ratio here, so don't worry what the numbers really mean. But look at this. So our group one rats, basically they show very little suppression. Okay? Look, they had very few avoidance learning trials. They only had to do one successfully. And so this makes sense. This fits with our two-process theory interpretation. It's like, yeah, those rats, they haven't had much experience with this. They've got relatively little training. Their conditional response is going to be pretty weak. So, you know, when they hear the tone, there's some fear generated, but it's not a lot. So the rats aren't that frightened. They don't suppress. They don't freeze that much. Not all of them freeze or not don't freeze for very long. It's like, okay, that makes sense. Group three. Oh, here we go. Look, we're getting more suppression here. Right, so we see that happening. We get a reduction as well. But again, by group three, you've had some more experience. Yeah, you would expect your CR to be stronger. Group the 9, it's like, yeah, okay, this is good. Here it goes. This makes sense. They should be getting a stronger conditional response here. Yep, they are more suppressed. But group 27. They're less suppressed. I mean, basically, they're not really suppressed at all here. They're less suppressed than your group 1 that only had one trial. But group 27 has had hundreds and hundreds of conditioning trials. They should have a really, really strong conditional response of fear. We should have, like, some sort of, if this kind of curve here seems to be right, they should be somewhere down around the negative 0.2 range on this graph. Instead, they're really not suppressed at all. In essence, they don't. It's like, yeah, tone. Keep pressing the lever. Don't freeze. Just keep responding. This is a bit of a problem for the two-process theory. But if you think about it again, you know, why should the group 27 rats really be that afraid? What have they learned? They've learned that they're really good at avoiding. It's like, yeah, I know exactly what to do. I just shuttle to the other side. I can stop myself from getting shocked. I'm an avoidance god rat. Okay? They're not afraid. Yeah. Oh, do they try to start shuttling? No, that's a good question. Do they transfer the shuttle box running into the operant chamber? No, they don't do that. Their response is to freeze. There's no place really they can run to. So we'll talk about predatory imminence and species-specific defense reactions a little bit later in the lecture today. So this seems to activate specifically their freeze-in-place response. Yeah. So this is a problem. Now, this is, I mean, like I said, other ones show, you know, we measured the blood pressure and stuff, and it doesn't seem to be changing here. And this one gets some very nice behavioral evidence that says these rats are not afraid. They should be the most afraid. They're not. There's another problem with this as well. And this is what I'm saying. Adamian seems to really like the two-process theory. That's fine. Everybody has their favorite theories. I get that. But he at one point even mentions that, sort of very briefly in the chapter, he says, well, you know, of course, you should be getting extinction effects as well. This should cause an alternation of behavior. And I'm not going to talk about that anymore at all. He goes on to the next thing. But this is a problem. The theory suggests, just working from the two-process theory itself, you should get a very odd behavioral output here. You should get a kind of alternation of behavior. So every successful avoidance response puts the CS onto extinction, right? In classical conditioning, CS paired with US, that's acquisition. CS without US is extinction. So we're going to get a weakening of the conditional response. Every time you successfully avoid, you're extinguishing the conditional response. Now, if your CR becomes extinguished, your fear is going to drop, so your motivation to avoid is going to decrease. You're not actually that scared in the presence of the CS, so you don't need to escape from it. Consequently, you stay put, and you get shocked. So now CS gets paired with the US, your CR regenerates, you start to generate fear again. Consequently, when the CS is presented, you become afraid, so you make the avoidance response, which so that you can escape from your scary CS. But that's going to put you back on to extinction, which should, again, reduce your conditional response, and so on, and so on, and so on. So your behavior should sort of yo-yo up and down with this. But we don't see this. Once avoidance responding becomes set, it really becomes set. Now, let's just take a look back here at the Kamen, Brimmer, and Black. See, this is essentially what's happened here with our group 27 rats. If you want to contextualize it this way, they've done a heck of a lot of successful avoidance responses. The CS is presented. There is no US that follows. Consequently, they've extinguished. And if we want to contextualize it this way, we could say they've extinguished their CR. So the reason why, you know, we now put them into the operant chamber, turn on the conditional stimulus. They don't suppress the responding because the CR has been extinguished. Now, keep in mind, this is a little bit different. So you might go, well, wait a minute. You said we should be getting an alternation of behavior. Yet not in this case, right? Because once they're put in the operant chamber, they're not actually going to get shocked, right? All that Kamen, Brimmer, and Black here were trying to do was see if they'd suppress their behavior for a few probe trials, right? So we're not going to get behavior going up and down. Yeah? Not in this study, so. Well, in the shuttle box, it's a CS plus for. Oh, yeah, but I'm just using, yeah, okay, so down here, so I said CS plus and operant chamber. I mean, we're taking this stimulus. Okay, that's all I mean. We're taking our auditory stimulus, the thing that we're trying to set up as a CS plus. I mean, even if you extinguish it, it's still a CS plus. It's just an extinguished CS plus. That's all. Remember we talked about, you know, extinction? We don't actually get rid of it. We just learned something else there. So it would have been our CS plus. It's just you know, we might interpret this through an extinction process. So, you know, that fits. You know, Cayman Brimmer's Black, Cayman Brimmer and Black's bit there fits with the idea that if you don't pair the CS with the US, if you make avoidance responses, yeah, you're going to extinguish the CR, and then you're not going to be afraid of the CS, and then why make an operant response that is going to go with fear? Well, you don't. If we just kept you in the shuttle box, so if you're just in the shuttle box, though, what we should see is an increase and decrease, a regular repetitive increase and decrease in terms of your shuttling response. Because, yeah, you're going to keep getting shocked there in the shuttle box. But we don't see that. So that's a bit of a problem for the two process theory here. In fact, actually, persistence of avoidance is a big therapeutic problem. This is a clinical problem as well, especially with phobias. So you develop a phobia to spiders, airplanes, toffee—I don't know, whatever it is. Britney Spears. I mean, that one actually makes sense. I see no reason to actually try to eliminate that phobia to Britney Spears music. But regardless. So if you've got a phobia towards something, you make an avoidance response. So you just never come in contact with spiders, you know. Today's front page of the Edmonton Journal. Spider! Big spider on it! This guy, Robin Leach, knew Robin years ago. He's called the Spider-Man. He likes spiders. He's an expert in spiders. He's got thousands of preserved pickle spiders in his house. Creepy as hell. It's just like, it's like, oh, yeah. Screaming heebie-jeebies. You know, I like my Charlotte Web spiders that save pigs and whatnot, but, you know, huge tarantula is a go. Anyways, but if you've got a phobia towards spiders, you're going to avoid anything that's going to take you anywhere near Dr. Leach. You're just going to avoid him like the plague. And that could be a problem if, for example, you're taking a class from him at Nate. So you may need to extinguish that avoidance. You know, haven't you come to class? No, because you terrify me. You're a stimulus that makes me feel intense fear. Oh, look, I wet myself. Okay, so how do we actually get rid of the avoidance response? We need to extinguish it. One approach is flooding, right? So we can actually force you to be in the presence of, in our hypothetical situation here, Dr. Leach's presence. And if no spider, like, you know, leaps out from behind him and pounces upon you, then things are good. You know, if you eventually realize that none of the pickled and formaldehyde spiders in his house can do anything to you, then great. So flooding. Also called response prevention, right? So we prevent you from making your avoidance response and nothing happens. Of course, if something bad does happen, then therapy has been a dismal failure. You have to actually ensure that the unconditional stimulus, that aversive outcome, will not occur. We have to actually put the subject onto extinction. Don't do this. Professor Gallagher and his controversial technique of simultaneously confronting the fear of heights, snakes, and the dark. Yeah, that would be bad. If you do go into therapy and do this, get paid in advance. Yeah?
I was just wondering, if you flood for a phobia, if you flood your response for something like a fear of spiders that's sort of adaptive, or snakes, or something like that, so then all of a sudden you're not really afraid of snakes at all? Is that how it works?
Like, yeah, essentially. You might, the idea is you might reduce this to a manageable level. The problem with the phobia is it's irrational.
Yeah.
Well, pardon me, I'm sorry, that's not correct. It's not irrational, it's excessive.
Yeah.
And so a fear of a rubber snake, or, you know, going to a movie with a snake, or going to the zoo with the snakes that are behind glass, and unless you're Harry Potter, they're not getting out of the snake enclosure. Those would be phobic responses. No, it doesn't say that, you know, it's like, if you've actually got a cobra doing this right in front of you, yeah, a bit of fear is probably a good thing at that point. It's like, okay, yeah, not good, as opposed to going, oh, cobra, love you, last thing you'll do. Right. So, I mean, the issue is to take the phobia into something that's manageable and allows you to do normal activities, but it's not trying to completely eliminate the fear. It's just trying to take it down to a normal sort of baseline level there. Okay. Incidentally, I don't think we'd get this through ethics today. So, Professor Gallagher has probably lost his license. Anyways, so we've got some difficulties with the two-process theory here. Explain something, seems to work in some cases. No question, definitely classical conditioning. If you classically condition a stimulus, a CS+ for fear, sure, definitely influences operant continuum. But, you know, we've already seen a discussion of how classical systems can interact with operant systems here. Also, kind of like your textbook when if you've read this part where it talks about the Sidmund free operant process and how, you know, question was, could you possibly have avoidance conditioning without a stimulus? This was a heretical question, but science depends upon the bold asking of just these questions to move forward. It's like, wow, holy smokes. It's like, I had no idea that we were this, like, you know, dramatic and, yeah. So I feel so heroic by, you know, being a psychologist. Anyways, so Sidmund. Sidmund says, yeah, okay, fine, right, good. So the obvious test then, the obvious test here of the two-process theory is, can you get avoidance responding without a CS? If the answer is no, in other words, if there's no classically conditioned stimulus and you cannot produce an avoidance response, then that's some pretty strong evidence in favor of the two-process theory. On the other hand, if you can get avoidance responding without a conditional stimulus that produces a CR fear, it's like, okay, so right back at you, two-process theorists, how do you explain that? So Sidmund invented what was called the free operant protocol, or the Sidmund free operant procedure. Basically, you're giving shocks at random intervals. So you've got a shock-shock SS. You've got a shock-shock interval. So from how much time between shocks there. And if you make a response, there's a response shock interval, some period of time of safety. Making a response gives you some safety. And so doing this sort of setup, Sidmund worked with rats, it took really extensive training, but the rats learned to make avoidance responses. They would make responses and get safe time, so they would significantly reduce the number of shocks they would receive. They still made errors. They still got shocked sometimes. It's certainly easier for rats to figure this out if you say, here's a stimulus that says shock is coming. But even if you don't do that, they still get this. I mean, the Rescorla and Lalordo study that we've already talked about there just said the dogs in the chamber, no signal. They start making an avoidance response. I guess dogs are a little bit smarter at this than perhaps the rats are. But, I mean, again, that's in essence, even though Rescorla and Lalordo weren't talking about it in terms of a free operant protocol, they were essentially doing this as well. What they were interested in was that if we import a CS, a specifically trained CS that we've conditioned completely separately here, can we alter the behavior, which they did. So the rats still get some shocks. They're never perfect at this. There's fairly high variability across subjects. Some rats were better at this than others. Some of them just, you know, never really quite got what's going on. I just don't understand. I keep getting shocked. What am I supposed to do? I hate this. But others did pretty well. So, you know, what we're seeing here is that we don't have an obvious conditional stimulus. One possibility that was raised by two-process theorists was as well, maybe time becomes the CS, right? We've got a response shock interval there. And so, and the way Sidman initially set this up, his initial setup was that, that you'd have fixed periods of safety, fixed safe times there. He says, well, so as your safe time starts counting down, as you get closer and closer to running out of time, and this would be the same thing with the Rescorla and Lalordo study as well. They would get like 20 seconds of safety, I think it was. As you start getting close to the time being up, then that starts, perhaps the time becomes the CS, and as you get close to the end of it, this generates fear, CR, and so you respond again because the time, the countdown, is making you afraid. It's like, okay, that's actually a kind of clever and fairly good response. We know that even non-human animals can track time. They're actually pretty good at it. They may not be able to count very well, but they're generally pretty good at estimating time. So it's like, okay, that's actually kind of a clever rebuttal to this. Sidman then went and did studies where the amount of safety that you get would be random as well. So it's like, yeah, okay. So we had a little bit of a problem there. Herrnstein and Heinlein in 66 said, okay, fine, let's eliminate time as a possible factor here. So they set it up such that rats would either get, they get shocked. They're going to get shocked. Whatever you do, you're going to get shocked. But here's your choice. You can either get a lot of shocks, we can shock you rapidly, or if you make a response, you'll be shocked slower for a while. The rate of shock will go down. Wait, let me think about that, say the rats. Yeah, I think I'm going to make the response. I'll just get fewer shocks. So what's happening here is the response will switch from a rapid to a slower schedule of shock delivery. It'll then shift back at a random point. Okay, so there's no timing component here that's going to tell you when you need to make additional responses. So you kind of have to keep responding to, at points here. Response then leads to a shock reduction, an overall shock reduction. If you will, this is a molar, right? This becomes a molar issue. It suggests what's happening is your subjects are, over the long run, going, if I respond, I'm still getting shocked, but I'm getting less shocks than if I don't respond, which is kind of interesting that perhaps they can do this in a molar way. And again, this was kind of interesting because the molar explanation fits with this very nicely. But back in the 60s, it was a little bit, again, heretical to suggest that non-humans had the cognitive capacity to manage to do molar interpretations of responses and outcomes. Nowadays, in the 21st century, it's like, yeah, we got a lot of evidence for that. Actually, non-human animals are surprisingly good at doing a lot of molar contextualization of things, long-run averaging, as long as it's something that they can kind of biologically get their little brains around, wrap their noggins around and do that. Some, in fact, in the right context, are far better than we are at doing this kind of thing. Other studies, other variants on Herrnstein and Heinlein's approach did things where they just put in delay. So it's if you respond, you're still going to get shocked, but you'll put it off for a while. So you'll delay it. So if you make a response, it's still going to happen, but it's not going to happen as soon. So in that case, you're still getting the aversive, but there's no stimulus that tells you what's going to be. You just put it off for a while. So again, we're finding an increasing, through the 60s, an increasing number of studies were coming out that were saying, we don't seem to have the conditional stimulus here for avoidance. Subjects are able to learn avoidance behavior without there being any really obvious conditional stimulus. This is a problem for the two-process process theory. So, this is what I was saying. It's a molar count. Basically, it goes back to it goes to negative reinforcement. Again, but in this case, the negative is that overall you get fewer shocks. So overall, some shocks are removed. Your behavior increases. Okay, so throughout the 60s, a series of very, very nice studies that also were very important for the field that eventually got founded of comparative cognition. which is showing that the cognitive capacity of non-humans is actually pretty impressive, right? We actually do some pretty impressive things. Okay. So, these studies necessitate a reinterpretation of avoidance learning. One of the first of these, we looked at this one, that it could be perhaps a molar account, things that will just in the long run overall reduce the aversives. In that case, there could be negative reinforcement. But we can also have molecular interpretations of this as well. And so one of these interpretations that came out was called the safety signals hypothesis. It's very much a molecular interpretation. And instead of it being based on a negative reinforcement, so instead of making responses to overall reduce the number of aversives that you're going to receive, this one works on a positive reinforcement. Trial by trial, if you make a response, you get safety. It's like playing Monopoly and getting that get out of jail free card. You got something. You got some safety. You made the response. You got safe. Woohoo! Now, you can set this up very explicitly in a laboratory study. You can set it up such that, say, you know, if you're on the black side of the shuttle box, you're going to get shocked. If you go to the white side of the shuttle box, that's where you're going to be safe. That's where you're not going to be shocked. Okay, this actually makes the avoidance learning really easy for things like rats and pigeons. It's like, yeah, I'm going over there to the safe side. I got a nice context cue. Bye-bye. Off they go. In the real world, you know, you don't have, things aren't always that blatant, and you don't even have to make them that blatant in the lab, but context cues, right? I mean, even if it's, you know, the left and the right side of the box, or this side or that side of the room or whatnot, there's asymmetries, there's differences in the appearance of the different sides of the, you know, different sides of a shuttle box. So you can tell the difference. So in that sense, your context cues then says, you know, by doing this response, I've changed my context and I get safety. I get to not be shocked. On this particular trial, this response means no shock. Hey. So the cues become, you can either describe them as a discriminative stimulus that says I'm getting safety, or if you like really like classical conditioning interpretations, you can describe these cues as CS minuses, right? Inhibitory conditional stimulus, as in the presence of this stimulus, the shock won't be delivered. Either way you look at it, certain stimuli indicate that you're going to get some safety. You're not going to get the shock. In that sense, we've got a positive reinforcement process coming in here. Okay? And again, we don't need to rely upon an initial classical conditioning component. It's not saying that you're making the response to get away from some fear caused by the stimulus that tells you that the shock is coming. We can even have a case that has no stimulus indicating the shock's coming, but if there's a stimulus that says, I just done it right, I mean, even if it's pressing a lever, right? Lever is now in the down position. Down position means I get some safety. Score. Okay? So that was one approach. Or probably two approaches, the molecular and the molar accounts there. SSDRs by Bowles. In the late 60s, early 70s, Bowles started proposing that different species will have species-specific defense reactions. These are biologically regulated innate responses. These are evolved. Different species are going to do different things, right? I mean, your kind of defensive reactions for a rat or a grizzly bear, obviously, we're probably going to have a few differences between those. Kind of different animals there, different places in the food chain, right? But what's interesting about this was, and this comes back to what we were talking about with freezing, right? Bowles was saying that, you know, there's going to be these species-specific kind of reactions. In different contexts, your species is going to do different things. And it says that some particular species-specific defense reaction is going to come to predominate in the early stages of avoidance. Fairly early on, they will hit upon something that will work. It's sort of a hierarchy. You know, there's the most likely response that will be made according to the particular species you're dealing with. If that works, if that causes a reduction in the aversive, great, keep it, just go with it. If not, hierarchy drops down to the next one. What's the next most likely thing that your species is going to do, and so on and so on and so on. So essentially, in this case, it's saying that the aversive outcome is the selector. So you try, it's like, uh-oh, threatening situation, try this, ooh! Still get punished, you know, I got punished, I got something aversive, scratch that, go to the next one. So in this sense, punishment keeps the subjects working through their hierarchy until they hit upon something that actually works. The most common SSDRs that we think about are the fight, flight, and freeze responses. But there's others. Thigmotaxis, heading towards a wall, if you are a rat. People will do this too, you know, under certain circumstances. If things are falling, you know, earthquake area, get close to a wall. Sucks if the wall falls on you, but, you know, it might deflect things that are going to fall from up higher. Get under a door, at least, door frame. Defensive burying. If there's like a little shock probe, if you brush against it, you will get a zap. Pile stuff on top of it so that you can't bump into it. If you've got, you know, if you very foolishly have some live wires, an electrical outlet that does not have an electrical outlet, you could get an electrician or fix this yourself by putting an outlet in, or you could just push a dresser up in front of it. It's kind of like burying it. Oh, I can't touch the live wires if I've got a dresser in front of it. Yeah. It's been nice knowing you. Light avoidance. Again, most rodents prefer to head into dark places. So there's lots of other ones out there. And Bohl said that the environmental content is also going to influence what's going to be selected. So, you know, freezing is not going to be a useful behavioral response if the predator is right in front of you. It's looking right at me. I'll just freeze and maybe it won't see me. Is it working? No, it's not going to. Running away or fighting might be your best option at that point if you're a, you know, a rat or a mouse or something like that, and there's a predator right in front of you. You might say, okay, well, wait a minute. You're in an operant chamber. How does freezing actually, how does that actually help you at all? It's not like freezing actually causes you to avoid the shock. You still get potentially shocked there, right? Well, there's nothing else our rat in the cage is really going to be able to do. It's like, I'm going to run over, bonk, and you hit the wall. You can't run away. There's nothing to fight, right? Standing next to the wall isn't going to help you. There's nothing to bury. Well, you can't get away from the light. So maybe by freezing, maybe by tensing up the muscles, maybe this actually reduces the aversiveness of the shock. So, you know, you can't escape. Well, you can maybe reduce the aversiveness. So you're avoiding some of the aversiveness in that way. Anyways. SSDR theory predicts that different species, we should find that some defensive responses, some avoidance responses, are going to be easier to learn than others. And we get this in the case of rats. Running on a wheel to avoid a shock, very easy to train. It's like, here you go, little rat. All you have to do is run away. It's like, okay, I'm a rat. I'm good at running away. Off I go. Here you go, little rat. All you have to do to avoid a shock is rear up on your hind legs and show that soft little fluffy tummy. It's like, what the heck? I have to show you my defenseless, soft tummy that can be torn open by a cat's sharp, nasty claws? That's really stupid. I'm not going to do that. Really hard to train rats to do that. Grizzly bears? Right? Threatened by something? Rawr! It's like, oh, look at that tummy. Oh, and the teeth and the claws and being 9.5 feet tall. Yeah, all right. You win. As opposed to trying to get a grizzly bear to run away. Now, you don't tend to use running wheels with grizzly bears. You need very large treadmills. Most researchers that work with grizzlies are missing some body part. So SSDRs. A related theory to SSDR is called predatory imminence. I will say, psychologists that work with grizzly bears, though, do get a certain amount of respect, right? It's like, oh, yeah, sure, fine, you work with grizzlies, but look at the bite I got from this rat. Look at this finger. It's like, yeah, you know, the grizzly bear workers have, like, hooks on their arm, you know, like pirates and stuff, missing a leg, that kind of thing. Anyhow, nobody actually works with grizzly bears in psychology. Would be pretty, you know, pretty manly, though. Hmm? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the guys get it. I will train grizzly bears, take over the world. Unfortunately, they're endangered, so there's not very many of them, so your army of grizzly bears would be very small. You could perhaps expand to koala bears, but they're not that dangerous. I'll just hang out in the eucalyptus tree. Don't take my drugs away from me. Okay, predatory imminence. I'm sorry, I'm horribly sleep-deprived, so I'm having a bit of a hard time tracking today. It's almost over, yes. Related to SSDRs, again, it's bringing in a biological component to things. It's saying, let's look at the specific biology. So what we're finally seeing here by the 70s is ethology, which had been going on very nicely since the early 20th century, kind of reintegrating with comparative psychology. You know, it's like, let's just not do this stuff just in the lab. Let's actually think a little bit about what the biology of these organisms are. Wait, you mean the biology of a rat isn't to live in a small cage on the third floor of the psychology building? It's like, yeah, no. There's something else. They didn't evolve just for that. It's like, oh, okay. So we start to see these biological conceptualizations coming in around this period. So predatory imminence. It says there's going to be different innate defensive behaviors that are going to occur at different levels of danger. So let's consider that we've got, you know, a predator and we've got a prey. So the predator, there's no way the predator can actually appear. Well, in that case, our prey here is going to be non-aversively motivated. It might engage in recuperative behavior. So let's say that you know, perhaps our prey has gotten away from something. You've just managed to escape. You know, you might start grooming or licking if you're a rat. If you've got cuts, a lot of animals have antibacterial components in their saliva, so they might engage in something like that. If there's the possibility that there's a predator in the area, you know, there's a scent cue or something, your prey item might start engaging in pre-encounter defensive behaviors. They might start looking around a lot more, running about, sniffing, getting to a higher vantage point, something like that. If a predator is actually detected, you get into a post-encounter defensive response. And this might depend on what happens. If the predator is far enough away, maybe you run. If you think it's likely you can actually get away before the predator could get to you, maybe you run. If the predator is a bit closer, maybe you freeze, because a lot of predators are sight-driven, movement, motion detector-driven. So if you're not moving, maybe it won't spot you. If the predator's really close, maybe get ready to fight. If the predator actually makes contact, for rats engage in what's called a strike defense mechanism. They will, boing, leap straight upwards, change their orientation. If they can land on the predator, they might try to bite it or get behind it and run off, something like that. Mongooses do this as well. If you've ever watched video of a mongoose fighting cobras, they'll do things like this. They'll jump around a lot. It makes it very hard for the cobra to actually score a hit, actually bite the mongoose. and if the cobra misses a strike and the mongoose is up, it'll twist in the air, try to land on the back of the cobra and bite through the back of the neck. So, you know, we've got these various specific responses, but predatory imminence theory says they're going to be linked to the proximity of the danger stimulus. So whatever it is that's eliciting whatever the danger is, you're going to get different responses, and these are going to be the most appropriate responses based upon the proximity, the imminence of the aversive. Now, despite the fact that, again, it's using biological components here, and it talks about, you know, it's a little bit confusing, unfortunately, because predatory imminence also talks about species-specific defense reactions or responses, but it contextualizes them specifically in terms of the proximity to the danger stimulus. So it is saying, yeah, there's these biologically species-specific things that are going to occur. So unfortunately, it uses some of the same terminology, but it is in fact a different theory. And here's some of the differences. So in this case, predatory imminence argues that these behaviors that are engaged in are going to be anticipatory. So they are in anticipation of the aversive, not in response to it. The SSDR theory says you encounter the aversive and you try your first most likely behavioral response, most likely SSDR. If that causes the termination of the aversive, you stick with it. If not, you go to the next one in your hierarchy in that sense. Predatory imminence says, no, you haven't got the aversive yet. You're anticipating the occurrence of the aversive, so you try something at that point. Second one that says that it's going to be the predatory imminence, actually the closeness to the thing that's going to deliver the aversive, not some sort of environmental cue, per se, that is going to lead to the response. Now, what it means here by environmental cue is actually the aversive itself. Okay, so you've actually gotten this aversive stimulus. Third, not going to be selected by punishment. Right? Again, in the case of the predatory, in the case of the SSDR, you try something. If it doesn't work, you've essentially been punished for trying that. That response decreases. You shift to another one. This one is saying you're actually going to stick with these based upon success. So you do things that works for you. Great, it was successful. Good. Okay. Why don't we take a break, and then we'll go on into this next section on punishment.